people in a company that really advocate for, yes, let's be bold and set a target. And then the legal department comes in and says, yeah, before you know it, we get litigation. Let's not do it.
But they're going to get litigation anyway. If they don't do anything, they're going to be litigated against as well. And we're going to be winning these cases.
Hey there, and welcome to Money for Change, the podcast where we dive into the sustainability transitions that are reshaping our world. If you're curious about where the planet and its inhabitants are headed, you're in the right place. In each episode, we'll chat with experts from Triodos Bank whose work relates to these changes, tackling topics like the energy transition, circular economy, and what sustainable finance really means. Our goal? To bring you the latest insights on what it takes to create a more balanced and just world. But we don't just want you to listen, we want you to be part of the conversation. Head over to our website via the link in the show notes and share your thoughts, ask questions, and leave us a voice message. Welcome to Money for Change. Let's get started. Welcome to Money for Change. My name is Sanne, one of the three regular hosts of this podcast. Thank you for tuning in. In this episode, we'll talk about a topic that receives quite a lot of attention in the media in recent weeks. In the Netherlands, a court case filed by Greenpeace to enforce the Dutch government to abide by its own law regarding nitrogen emissions and nature protection was won by the environmental organization. This court victory has caused much political debate and controversy. In recent years, lawsuits to force climate action from either governments or companies have taken a leap. Some cases are won, some are lost, like the case Friends of the Earth filed against Shell and lost in the appeal at the High Court. So today, we will talk about the impact of strategic litigation in the climate transition. Do these court cases help to speed up the much-needed action, or have they become an obstacle for companies and governments to set meaningful climate goals? And do they actually get society on board in the climate transition, or do they put people off? We have invited Evie de Kroon, a legal expert and lead campaigner at Greenpeace, to discuss these questions. Welcome to the show, Evie.
Thank you.
And as always, Hans Tegeman, Triodos Bank chief economist, will join the conversation. Welcome, Hans.
Thank you.
Let's set the scene. Evie, you are an expert in this field. Can you briefly explain to the listeners what is strategic climate litigation?
Yeah, so strategic litigation is a tool to protect and defend the interest of normal people, because the law is supposed to help people, right? But what we see is that governments who are supposed to do this get sidetracked at best, or influenced or bought at worst by businesses who try to have governments protect their interests over the back of normal people, over our livelihoods. But luckily, we have constitutions, we have international laws, we have human rights laws that actually trump politics. So they are there while politicians come and go, and the laws are supposed to protect us all at the same time. And what we see is that strategic litigation is being used to challenge laws or challenge policies for the sake of all of us. So it's not new. People have always been going to court, right? And a very well-known example of strategic litigation is a case from the US in 1954, I think. It's Brown v. Board of Education. Okay. In which people went to court to challenge racial segregation in schools. Mm-hmm. And they did so effectively. It worked because the court struck down these policies. So yeah, strategic litigation is supposed to help and benefit us. And you asked, how about strategic litigation in the field of climate change? Mm-hmm. Climate change is new. Mm-hmm. I mean, relatively new. Businesses and also governments, but especially businesses, have known about climate change for a very long time, the effects of climate change, also the legal risks of climate change, and decided not to do anything.
There was a report dating back from the 60s, I think, right? Made by Shell.
and Exxon
as well, right?
Yes. They have known but withheld this information and actually lobbied against any policies that were there to protect us. Mm-hmm. So what we see now is that climate change is impacting people. It's not just about the whales and the turtles and the polar bears. Actually, people are being impacted. And usually now that's the people who have contributed the least, who are affected the most.
And should I see it then that the climate litigation, the litigation cases are meant to primarily protect people, that it's a human rights issue?
Especially in the field of climate change, human rights have been used as a way to protect people. So Urgenda was the first case in which citizens brought a case to courts against governments, and they effectively made the link between human rights and climate change and effectively got protection.
Maybe we should, I think you also know the case, Hans. So for the listeners who don't know, it was an NGO called Urgenda in the Netherlands that filed a case against the Dutch state, right? Yeah.
Yes, correct.
What was it about?
It was the first time in the world that a court established that there is a legal duty to protect people against climate change. Mm-hmm. And in this specific case, the court basically just ordered the state to observe, to follow its own laws, to execute its own laws. And that meant that they had to reduce CO2 emissions by 25% by the end of 2020. Mm-hmm. And what is very interesting about this case is that it's being copied all around the world, right? Because human rights are supposed to be universal. We're supposed to all have the same human rights. So it's a very effective tool to use.
So now, actually, it sets a precedent for other countries to abide by that same principle.
Exactly.
So
we see it within the Netherlands. So I'm guessing we'll be talking about some of the cases that are being brought.
Definitely. Mm-hmm.
It's a blueprint for cases within the Netherlands, but also internationally. Yeah, we see that it's being copied all over the world.
And maybe it's interesting also for the listeners to hear about a couple of cases that are going on or that have been really iconic, because I can imagine not everyone has heard of these cases. So can you go over a couple of these cases?
Certainly. I think what is interesting to make the distinction between cases that are being brought by people who are hit the hardest, disproportionately hard, and maybe businesses, because those are two quite new trends within strategic litigation, because human rights are traditionally supposed to be protected by the state, right? But we see that that scope is now expanding. So maybe firstly, disproportionately affected people, because the climate crisis is here and it's hitting really hard, we see that those people are now turning to court because they're not finding protection from the government and also not businesses who are causing it. So a very important case was actually won some months ago. Mm-hmm. It was at the European Court of Human Rights, where a group of senior Swiss women...
The Swiss grannies, they are called, right?
They don't like being called the Swiss grannies.
Oh, I'll take it back immediately.
Otherwise you get litigation against you.
Exactly, we use it against everyone and everything. They're called the Klimaseniorinnen. Mm-hmm. And their complaint is that due to climate change and the heat waves that are caused by climate change, their health is impacted and they have a higher risk of dying because they are elderly and they are women. Mm-hmm. And this was a very big group of women. And the court indeed acknowledged and confirmed that Switzerland violated their human rights and that it had to do a lot more to prevent them from dangerous climate change. And what is so interesting about this case is that climate change is a global phenomenon. It's a global problem, but we don't have like a global court. So you see that all of these national courts are struggling with this issue. Mm-hmm. But what we really need is like an international court to actually give clear guidance and pathways, right? So what the European Court of Human Rights has now established is that all countries within the Council of Europe, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's 46 states.
That's wider than the EU.
It's wider than the EU. Yeah. 46 countries is also quite a lot, and it's all European countries. Mm-hmm. So these are the big users of CO2, right? The big emitters. Yeah. They all need to do more. That's basically the implication of this verdict from the European Court.
One question I have always, you say now, they all need to do much more, but what's the enforcement mechanism that you can use then?
Yeah, so now basically we have a blueprint and we can enforce it at every national level because there's this authoritative, legally binding verdict from the European Court.
To, again, go to court in every country of the 46 countries?
Well, hopefully, hopefully we don't need to, right? Yeah. Because we hope that the Dutch state is now paying attention and will actually adjust its policies. And you can already see that this case is now popping up in other cases that are already pending at the Dutch courts, right? As we will come to talk about in the Shell case, for example.
But such a like international court, is that already kind of in the making, or is there any traction for such an institution to, especially in current geopolitics?
I mean, yeah, you're treading on the sovereignty of states, right? Yeah. So states will never be willing to give their their legal options to a international court. But there is a advisory opinion coming out from the International Court of Justice, probably this year still, which will give very clear authoritative guidance for courts to interpret the responsibilities of states in the face of climate change.
Yeah, and then unfortunately, there are a couple of states who don't recognize the International Court of Justice, right? So that's the issue with that, that it's not, doesn't have a global reach.
But it will have a very authoritative interpretation of international laws that are binding on all states in the world. So, but maybe because you asked about some international case or Dutch or international cases, right?
Yeah.
These cases are being brought by people who are disproportionately hit hard by the climate crisis. And also within the Netherlands, we have groups, just like the Klimaatvereniging, who are hit disproportionately hard. And we have islands in the Netherlands. We have six islands that are part of the European Netherlands that are geographically located here. But there's also six islands in the Caribbean that are part of the Netherlands.
The Dutch Kingdom.
Yes, of the Dutch Kingdom. Three of which are parts, are special municipalities of the country of the Netherlands, one of which is Bonaire. And eight people from Bonaire, supported by Greenpeace the Netherlands, brought a case to the Dutch government, because we found that even though we know so much about the Netherlands in terms of climate change, all of these policies are being made, plans are being developed, adaptation measures are being taken. Bonaire is being hit really hard by the climate crisis.
So here in the Netherlands, like we are talking about, you know, a lot of extra water coming down, hitting farmers, farmlands, or, you know, droughts, etc. But in these island states, it's really their existence, right, that is at stake.
Exactly. It's an existential threats. Yeah. In fact, when we started looking into climate justice within the Netherlands, we found that even though there were very clear signs that climate change is hitting the Caribbean very hard, there was no specific research done into the effects on islands like Bonaire. Mm. So we asked the Free University to do such a research, and they came up with very shocking facts, even that within some decades, a fifth of the island can be permanently flooded, which obviously has a massive effect on such a small island.
That's a totally different conversation than what we are having here. Like, we're talking about, okay, let's insulate our house, or let's buy a heat pump or whatever. And this is really
At the same time, a large part of our country is 6 meters under sea level.
True.
What I mean to say with that is that we are actually water managers pur sang. Like, that's what we are as a country, as Dutch people. If there's something that we can do, is actually to keep the water out. So it's not a problem that cannot be overcome. But yeah, these people, these citizens from Bonaire who brought this case, they demand from the Dutch government that they actually go and do it. They come up with an adaptation plan together with them, but also that they take their fair share in keeping the world under 1.5 degrees global warming, because that's so important, especially for small islands like Bonaire.
Thanks for explaining these cases. What I want to do next is actually dive into the effects of climate litigation. Of course, we've seen in several cases that either the government or companies are blinded by stricter targets or stricter climate action, like the Urgenda case that you mentioned, Evja. What I'm wondering, you can win a case, but you can also lose a case, like happened with Shell, right? So their Friends of the Earth took Shell to court. They first won the case. I'm not sure, but that's a normal court where they filed the case.
It's the court of first appeal, yeah, a civil law court.
A civil law court. And then now that verdict was kind of overthrown by a high court. And then the case was lost, so to say. But then you take three steps back, right?
Well, actually, the case wasn't lost. And I think that's really a matter of framing.
Oh, that's good to know. How does that work?
Because if you look at the verdict, it's very clear that the court really wanted to set very clear guidance and very clear norms. So the court established that Shell has its own responsibility to respect human rights, to stop pay its share in stopping climate change, and also that it need to reduce emissions. What the court wasn't able to do, and that's when people say we lost the case. But what the court didn't do was on the basis of scientific consensus, they said we cannot say that there's a specific reduction percentage.
Yeah.
And in fact, Friends of the Earth, the Netherlands, Milieudefensie, announced just a few days ago that they are appealing this decision because they are convinced that there is scientific consensus at least to set a minimum standard for it.
I have a question. I'm an economist. And for an economy, it's very essential to understand the rule of law. So to have some idea what the rules of the game are and how you can play it or not. And I'm very in favor of strategic litigation because we have laws and they should be justified. However, what I see happening in, for instance, the financial sector and other places is that a lot of litigation also leads to a less outspoken businesses that say, hey, but if I'm going to promise or set a target or set an objective and I cannot make it, I get litigation.
Mm.
So my question more or less, and I don't know how you see it, it takes a lot of time. Sometimes the results of litigation are not that positive as previously expected. And it also hinders some businesses to speak up.
Mm.
And that worries me sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see that?
I think if I was a business, I would also not like being regulated. I would also not like it if I'm being told what to do. And they're not used to it anymore either, right?
No.
Because they've been ruling the world and basically destroying our planet. So I think that is something.
There are also good guys, I think. There are still some good guys.
Sure.
And what I see happening, especially in the financial sector, because we are in finance, is that, yes, there are companies that really want to set an object of people in a company, I have to face it a little bit differently, that really advocate for, just let's be bold and set a target. And then the legal department comes in and says, yeah, I don't know. Before you know it, we get litigation. Let's not do it.
Yeah.
But they're going to get litigation anyway. If they don't do anything, they're going to be litigated against as well. And we're going to be winning these cases. Because
Also with the current, that's an interesting question. I think we're at this turning point as well, right? If we look at the development of politics in the US and also in Europe, then the question is if we're going to be winning these cases, right?
Well, yeah, I think so, because that's the trend that we're on. And I think that there's a few things to keep in mind. One is that fossil fuels are dead. I mean, at some point, we cannot be emitting CO2 anymore, and it's becoming a massive financial risk as well. So I think it's in the...
For me, it's not so easy because, we can emit carbon as long as we wish to if we accept the damage. And second, why should it be a private issue? So who pays for the damage in the end?
That's a very good question. Who pays for the damage? And I think at some point the financial risks become so big that the damages to houses in many places in the world is already becoming so big because of climate change that people cannot insure their houses anymore. The impact is becoming so big that people cannot repair their houses anymore. They cannot live in their houses anymore. They often, homeowners' pension are connected to their houses that they own. So the financial risks are actually becoming very big. And I think that...
Looking at the financial sector, I think there are a lot of financial institutions that do see these risks. Mm-hmm. And some of them care more than others and are kind of well willing to take steps, maybe not enough, but at least... And we also see them becoming more cautious. So I think the question or the point Hans was also raising is like, does it really help the litigation when it comes to, when the effect is that companies actually pull back from commitments or don't dare to say anything anymore in public? How do you think about that?
I think companies, like, they are not making these promises out of their the goodness of their heart, like out of their own kindness. They've been making these promises.
Except for Triodos Bank, of course.
Of course. But they've been making these promises because they are making a profit, right? Well, and now they're being held to their promises and they are trying to back away, some of them. Well, a lot of them are not. And I think what you see, we're on a path that we cannot go back on. Like, customers are expecting clean goods, but also employees, they don't want to work for a climate killer. Also, companies...
Especially the young people, right? Yes. The young professionals, yeah.
And companies and banks might be saying, like, well, we don't want to set these targets anymore, which I know that they don't want to. Mm-hmm. But there's also legislation in place that is forcing them to be transparent, to actually make promises, to be responsible. And obviously, it would be pretty insane to me, living in a rule of law, that then I wouldn't be going to court if no one's protecting me from the impact from these companies and governments that are not enforcing the rules.
Yeah, but those financial institutions need to be transparent, but they can still finance fossil fuels if they want to. There's no problem with that. So even...
Yeah, you mean transparency hasn't helped us to get more climate action?
No, there's no enforcement for a financial institution, except for their own pledges that they made and they sometimes now regret, to do anything on climate. Mm-mm. And that's where I see, so on nature and other stuff, where you really want also the financial sector to be not committed, and they step back. And I see that as one of the... So that was my question also.
Yeah.
Does it always help a transition to do strategic litigation?
Or when does it help, when doesn't it help?
Yeah.
Do you have these dilemmas within Greenpeace?
Obviously, strategic litigation, it's not a silver bullet. It's not something that you sort of pull out of your pocket and just shoot with it. Mm-hmm. You have other tools for that.
Yes.
Strategic litigation
So it's one tool in a toolbox.
Yes, exactly. And what strategic litigation has proven to do is, and there's actually research that shows this as well, is create public awareness, for example. So basically, climate change has become a communication issue, right? We have all of the solutions, but they're not being implemented. And we know of strategic litigation that it's very appealing to the media, a court case. So we see that allows us to speak to the public in a very framed way, to convince the public and to get support from it. And if I may add one final point about sort of the effect of strategic litigation, is that laws, my colleague said this very well recently, a colleague from Bonaire, she said, the laws have been used against us for centuries. Now we are using laws to our advantage. Okay. That's what human rights are supposed to be doing. Mm. And I think that's where strategic litigation is also very effective in challenging the status quo, in challenging the power dynamics and putting back the power where it's supposed to be with the people.
Lovely. I would actually like to talk a lot more about this topic, but for now, it's really time, Hans, to go to your dreadful, hopeful news item.
My dreadful
What's
news.
It going to be?
The news this week, it was terrible. So I was looking, we recorded this on Monday.
It wasn't a good week, huh?
No.
I can agree on that.
And I was looking at the front page of the Dutch Financial Times and all of others, and there was a lot of news on the end of green capitalism. So for a while, and for the last few years, it seems like many companies will make a serious commitment, like we also discussed, on sustainability, climate goals, all kinds of nice positive things, business for good, you know, all of that. But just the news of the last week or last few weeks, Shell have scaled back their climate ambitions, focus really more on fossil fuel. Unilever has retreated from a sustainability focus. Nestle.
Rabobank, I also saw.
Rabobank, yes, is growing less a better world together. Large automakers like BMW, Toyota, slowing down their electrification. A lot of bad news on...
And now you're only talking about green, because there was other bad news.
Yeah, there was also on diversity, on Deloitte on diversity, for example.
Kept coming in.
Yeah, it was a lot. So, and there is an economic theory, I'm not going to explain it. So people were thinking, yeah, but maybe companies, because they understand business better and also know what they do worse, can, if they do the right thing, do that better than the government.
That
was an economic theory in high-level journals and really saying pro-social businesses can make a difference as a reflection that businesses are only there for profit, like Milton Friedman says in 1970, and had the sustainable goal of business.
Don't get too nerdy, Hans.
this is at the heart of economics, and then you can see that how it shifted, given this green bubble, and now it explodes. So and now I'm getting really cynical. So this was the green capitalism story. We can have businesses doing good, sometimes we need some litigation, but for the rest they really make great stuff. And for me, last week we really saw the end of that green capitalism fairy tale, which is very sobering, because we also work at a company that wants to do good and impact first. And so it can be the case, but in the bigger scheme of things, I don't see it happening. And then we have only one choice, and that is to build that great transformation, to think about the root cause of all this.
And at the same time, I'm sorry that I have to bring in a positive note, but we also see, you know, smaller businesses coming up business models.
But it's not the big business. The business that get litigated. So I see a lot of new cases coming up the coming years on strategic litigation. So that's maybe the good news.
Lots of work for you, Ethan.
Yes.
All right.
I'd rather not, but I'll do it if we have to.
If you win enough cases, then it will have its effects, right?
Well, you only need one really impactful one.
Yeah, and the rest will follow. So let's hope on that.
Yes, fingers crossed. So thank you both for joining. It's about time to end this 14th episode of Money for Change. Thank you, Evje, for your contribution. And Hans, as always, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
And of course, thank you for the listener for tuning in. And hope you will do that again next week.
That's a wrap for this episode of Money for Change. We hope you found today's conversation insightful and inspiring as we continue to explore the transitions that are shaping our world and our future. If you enjoyed what you heard, don't forget to hit the subscribe button so you never miss an episode. Thanks for tuning in to Money for Change.